Hi everyone, my name's Jake Entwistle and welcome to another episode of the Squawker Talker podcast. As always, this season, this episode is sponsored by BetBull, and if you would like to follow us on their app, then please download it. Make sure you're over 18 and that you are gambling.
Just in case you didn't know whether you were over 18.
Make sure you are, yeah. Well, it's like people are using that app now, aren't they, to do their astrology. And there was a meme saying that everyone's texting their mum now to find out the day they were actually born the time. Yeah. So, you can kill two birds with one stone. You can do your astrology and also then realise if you're 18 and download the BetBull app.
And get in touch with your mum, because you probably don't text her enough.
No, you don't. And she might want to be involved as well, because after all, BetBull is a community. So get your mum involved and anyone else that you might want to get involved. Download the app and follow Squawker for all of our predictions that will hopefully be coming this week. But if not, you can follow plenty of other more intelligent people predictions-wise. But Will's already piped up, so you know he's on the podcast this week.
Correct.
Welcome back. Mo is also on the podcast this week.
I am.
Return of Carabao Cup was actually quite a good week, I thought.
It was good. There was good action. There was some hilarious surprises. Some hilarious almost surprises. Like I still think the funniest thing in the round is Rochdale taking Man United penalties and coming very close to actually winning.
With a 16-year-old scoring.
With 16-year-old, I mean, that was amazing. United score, you know, 17-year-old scoring. Oh, man, United great. Rochdale's like, hold my beer, lads. 16-year-old right back.
Or no, don't hold it.
No, don't hold
because
it.
Because he's 16.
16-year-old right back. Hold my ginger beer.
Yes.
Comes out of nowhere. It was a nice goal. Nice finish. Andres Pereira is literally good for nothing. It was good fun. And the next round's going to be even better, I think.
Yeah.
A couple of real blockbusters.
This was the return of the Carabao, why I like the Carabao Cup, because every team, every big team, and I know some people don't actually like it for this, we got to see so many of those young players play, and not only just play, prove that they were all quite good. Arsenal, Martinelli, 18-year-old, came in and scored two goals. Chelsea's Wonder Kids all returned and smashed Grimsby 7-1. Harvey Elliott impressed on his debut, again, just 16 years old. How did Wimbledon get on, Sam?
We're knocked out.
That was my introduction. I felt that was slightly mean, but I needed to obviously tell everyone that you're on the podcast this week. Wimbledon are actually struggling at the moment, aren't they? Because their manager,
as always, Jake.
Yeah,
constant
as always.
Struggle. But at least Milton Keynes went out. So
yeah, there you go. That kept Sam happy this weekend. But we won't be talking about the League Cup itself. We won't be reviewing it in full. We're going to start straight away with the biggest game of the weekend. But it's not even on the weekend. Monday Night Football returns, and it's Man United versus Arsenal. And this game is important because both of them have been heavily criticised already this season. Man United, obviously, as we just mentioned, struggling against Rochdale at Old Trafford in the League Cup. Pogba started, Pogba returned. And Rochdale themselves were... I saw some tweets saying that they'd lost to Man City's under-21s.
They got beat by Peterborough recently, 6-0.
6-0. So not the best preparation for Man United going into the game. Whereas Arsenal, as I mentioned, had that 5-0 win. Rob Holding back, Kieran Tierney made his debut, Hector Bellerin back.
Callum Superman Chambers.
Exactly. Callum literally might as well just play all defensive positions on his own, and then Arsenal might be able to actually plug their midfield against Man United, which is where I want to start, because anyone that's been following Squawker, and even myself, if you've managed to go that far, will know that I am personally quite concerned for Arsenal going into this game, because, and I have worked it out, in Arsenal's games this season, there has been a shot every 2.7 minutes in a game, of which Arsenal are facing one every 5 minutes. And although Man United have looked completely incapable of actually breaking down any team, I feel like this NBA style of football from Unai Emery is actually going to let Man United off the hook, because they've got such a porous midfield that you don't actually need any creativity to have shots against Arsenal, because they will most likely lose possession in the midfield and not have any structure in place to prevent you from shooting against
them. They give it up. I mean, the big thing, I said this about Marcus Rashford, is he's kind of like the Dothraki. He's unbeatable in the open field. You know, when he can run at you, forget about it. So, but you get behind your high walls in your castle and he's like, looks completely lost, can't do anything. Arsenal are like, yeah, come on, let's play. It'd be great fun. It's like, don't go for a kick around in the park. You know, they just want to open field, want to play an attack. And that's great for Arsenal. And it makes them fantastic viewing. Well,
it's not great for Arsenal at all.
It makes them fantastic viewing for neutrals, but, and it makes them a potent attacking force. And I think I'll go into it in a minute, but if there's certain key players before, I think Arsenal will have enough to beat Man United. But at the same time, It is like almost, this is the dream opponent for Man United. Like Chelsea, mate, there's a reason Man United beat Chelsea 4-0 and then couldn't do a damn thing against Wolves, against Palace, against who are objectively worse teams than Chelsea.
Man United scored 4 against Chelsea and they haven't scored multiple goals in a game since. In fact, in their Premier League games, they've only scored 4 since they scored 4.
Exactly. And it's just because, I think Arsenal were unwittingly, because Unai Emery can't help it, even when he game plans, and he game plans very well usually. He will, because he'll want his team to play offensive football. He's got a team that's set up to do that. He hasn't got a team that can just sit back and counterpunch, really. I mean, he technically has, but that's not his style of play.
No, but this is the problem with Emery, is he is playing like a team that wants to sit and counterpunch, but there are no triggers or patterns that actually develop it. Against Watford, Arsenal sat so deep and tried to counter-attack, and it was so obvious that's what they were trying to do. But every time they won the ball, they didn't know what to do. Against Liverpool, it sort of was more visible because Liverpool was so much better that Arsenal were just there, and it was give it to Pepe and let him run. That was when I got on that rant about it being like Crystal Palace. It turns out Arsenal are actually playing like a mid-table side in every single sense. But again, this is me sort of projecting my frustration more so, and it's probably maybe it's not completely fair. And then with Man United as well, despite them being perceived to be really struggling at the moment, it's when you look at expected goals, only Man City have a greater expected goals differential than Man United in the Premier League this season.
So your fear is that they're going to create quite a few chances against Arsenal, but I'd say the main frustration, certainly based on Solskjaer's post-match comments after the Rochdale performance last night, was their inability to take the chances. So I think, yeah, it's a legitimate fear, but there's also an encouraging sign in that United's sort of finishing hasn't.
When Marcus Rojo is taking 7 shots, it's going to make your finishing numbers look bad. I think he took the most shots on the pitch. Mason Greenwood was next. Rojo had 1 on target, which was typical. That's what the Carabao Cup's about.
Yeah.
Fringe players coming in and taking their chance by just shooting from absolutely anywhere.
James Milner against MK.
It worked for him.
He was absolutely on one. Actually,
for Man on Fire, Klopp said, I think.
Yeah, for all the talk of the young players.
See, I thought it was interesting.
Milner really shined.
I thought it was interesting. But that's where he's invaluable, though, isn't it? Yeah. And have Milner.
But that's what I'm saying. Isn't it interesting, though, you compare Milner to Pogba and the way that Milner carried or led the young players at Liverpool to this victory. And Pogba, I mean, he had one of those games, where it's the Marshall Lynch quote, I'm just here so I don't get fined. It just looked like he's there, he's playing because he's been told to play. Like he looked like he had, I have to say this, I don't know the man's motivations.
He had a couple good chances early
on. Yeah, but it just looked like he just wasn't interested at all. He wasn't really...
It's because it was Rochdale at home at Old Trafford. I know it's bad, but they probably expected to just win that.
Yeah, of course, but then I think some of the results show that you can't get away with playing a disjointed, uninterested team like West Ham at Oxford, for example. So Jack Wilshere playing in centre mid there. Does he want to be playing in that game? No, he definitely doesn't. But his opposite number certainly does, and we'll be thinking this could be a career defining performance for me. Yeah. So I like to see the big clubs not get away with it because it's a bit sort of arrogant to treat it as, we can get away with just playing our players who are maybe coming back from injury or
But that's why the young players should play, and that's why they always perform, because they're seeing it as
a chance.
That's an actual first team opportunity, I've been playing in this team for ages, I've got a bad knee, I'm going to coast
through. That's why Wenger's teams always did so well when he played all these kids, and everyone's like, oh my God, they're the greatest kids ever. It wasn't that they were all the greatest young players ever, they were all talented, they all had a system to play in, and they all really wanted to play the game.
The drawers take back to Anfield for Arsenal and the Carabao Cup, which the ghost of Julio Baptista.
so what you're saying is...
And they've got a Brazilian forward again.
I was going to say, what you're saying is Gabriel Martinelli is going to score 4 goals.
Literally, I did that because I actually was sad enough to make a Photoshop of his head on Baptista's body last night out of excitement of the draw. But the Carabao Cup is back. I was excited. But we need to... As I said, we're not talking about the Carabao Cup. We're talking about Arsenal versus Man United. And the fact that... And I mentioned the sort of NBA shots, minutes per shot, in Arsenal's games. They've been involved in the most shots in the Premier League, which is 196. So every game is guaranteed to produce shots for either team. And it was only against Nottingham Forest, which again, it was a championship opposition at home, where they sort of comfortably outshot their opponent. The major problem with Arsenal under Unai Emery is that, and again, after the Watford draw, I posted some stats about their shots on target versus the shots on target they're facing. And they're the only big team that's under performing in terms of how many shots they're producing versus their opponent. But they have Aubameyang. And this time and time again, and the reason why I said they'd be fourth on our preview was that they have one of the best strikers in the league. And and since his debut, he's caught up with Mohamed Salah now. Salah's the only player with more Premier League goals since Aubameyang made his debut, but it's 39 to 38 now, when before it was Salah was stretching that incredible run and it was he was 10 ahead of everyone else. And of the 40-plus players to score 10-plus goals since Aubameyang's debut, he has the highest conversion rate. 26.21%
because he misses so many chances.
Exactly,
as well.
But this is the thing. And it was that free kick against Aston Villa that was like a slam dunk moment, and that's what Arsenal have been relying on. It's the sense that they have this NBA style of football where they're relying on a star player to win them games rather than actually just having a coherent system. And there've been all those rumours that came out after the Arsenal game about Arsenal players not understanding the tactics or weren't really sure what to do. Ainsley Maitland-Niles, I think, came out and said, I was annoyed how we played against Watford. I think it was specific to the passing out. It was like, we should have just changed it. So there seems to be this rift between what's being told of the players and then actually doing it. And it's people like Aubameyang that are just quality enough to say, whatever you tell me to do, I'm still going to have that moment of magic. And we saw
it. That's it. Aubameyang is basically Arsenal's James Harden, right? He puts the team on his back and he'll score goals. And he's why, him and Danny Tabas are why I think, even for all of Arsenal's, like, I mean, just the flaws and the problems that they have, like you say, and the fact that they 100% play into Man United's hands, the fact that they have those two, and if those two show up on the day, United have nothing that can live with Danny Tabas in midfield, and they have no... I mean, Maguire's a great defender, but Aubameyang is so fast, and that's the one thing Maguire's not fast. So if those two show up and have a really, really good game and are in that sort of mood, if Aubameyang is clinical, it's I think Arsenal will win the game purely because there's no United don't have any counter to that at all. Whereas if United can keep a lid on one or both of them,
The reason why I'm so, and to round off the actual sort of tactical preview of the game result-wise, the reason why I'm so pessimistic is Man United have shown that they can, I know they lost to West Ham 2-0, that was just an abject display all around. They've shown this season that they can defend. Against Leicester, they kept them out. And Arsenal have struggled to break teams down because they've tried to launch this counter-attacking style, but if a team sits back, then they look loss of ideas. So I think this Man United Arsenal game is perfect for Ole Gunnar Solskjaer because it lets him use his counter-attacking style, and Arsenal will not have any traps really to actually counter it, so they can counter-attack at will whilst also not being under threat from a cohesive attacking unit. They just have to hope that it's Aubameyang that doesn't come up with that moment of real special quality to punish them.
I think it's going to be a 1-1 draw that Manchester United kind of dominate but fail to kill off for, I mean, the reasons I gave earlier. Solskjaer is unhappy about that. Their game management has been poor in the sense that I think they've dropped the most points from winning positions of any Premier League team since Ole Gunnar Solskjaer took over. And that game management is something we always associate with inexperience, and they are an inexperienced but exciting team. And also Arsenal... I think bar Man City have scored the most goals inside the last 15 minutes of games this season. So you can just see Aubameyang popping up to punish a sort of moment of complacency, maybe.
Well, he's been doing some Thierry Henry impressions recently, so maybe we get another one at Old Trafford. Leading into that, in terms of he wore the captain's armband when he scored that winner against Man United, a lot of discussion this week has been around sort of Arsenal's leadership group and whether Aubameyang has now elevated himself into pure captain material. Granit Xhaka, the much maligned Granit Xhaka, who is the most polarizing midfielder, I think, in the Premier League in terms of a fan base.
Pogba.
Pogba as well, yeah. Well, we've got two of them on the same pitch, potentially. So it'll be really interesting to see which one comes out. But do you think, Sam, one, what's your actual opinion of this whole leadership group that Arsenal have? And two, do you think Aubameyang has proven himself maybe to be at the top of that list and replace someone like Xhaka, who, for all his positives, they can never seem to outweigh the negatives?
I actually think it's pretty worrying that Emery is still umming and ahhing over this decision midway through the season. Well, we're sort of six games in and they still haven't got a standout leader. So when he came in last season, obviously Koscielny was his main captain, and then Cech, Ramsey, Ozil and Xhaka. So two of them... only two of them, sorry, are still at the club. As you said, Xhaka being booed by his own fans. Ozil.
Six chances created in 60 minutes, but charges off, or will get subbed off against Nottingham Forest. Maybe he's saving him for Old Trafford.
Maybe.
But continue.
Yeah, I just think that the accusation that's always thrown at Arsenal is them not having enough leadership in the dressing room. But if the guy at the top, Emery, can't even settle on choosing a leader from the group, then that's pretty damning.
Mm.
Some of the names that are sort of being thrown into potentially being in the leadership group, Rob Holding, Guendouzi. For me, they should be nowhere near a leadership group. It would be unfair to make them captain because they're too young.
Within seconds of Rob Holding putting on the captain's armband against Nottingham Forest, he headed in Arsenal goal. So maybe it's written in the stars, Sam.
Well, put at another top six club, you wouldn't be anywhere near the sort of captaincy. I just don't like the leadership group in general. By all means, have it behind closed doors, or you can sort of know that you have a vice or a second vice, but to sort of
be so open about it.
Yeah, it's like everyone knows. This is a leadership group. To me, it's just you're skirting around the choice. For me, if I was sitting in the changing room, I would want him to say, you're the leader, because Arsenal need a figurehead. Which I don't know whether Aubameyang is right for it, purely because I think that he should be allowed to just focus on his goals, and it might take a bit away from him.
It's the Henri. It's when Henri got the captaincy for Arsenal. It was just, you're by far our best player.
Yeah. Well,
it was like
Beckham with England, wasn't it?
Yeah, Van Persie.
It wasn't Henri like good with young players as well. Like, and that's what I mean. There's that story Martinelli saying about Aubameyang just walked up to him and started speaking in Portuguese when he first showed up. So he has that leadership already.
And of course, he's doing like with Pepe. He gave him the penalty, so he's making a lot of sort of.
God, don't look at Man United penalties. if you're a penalty taker, take it.
He's making a lot of the right choices in that sense, but Gary, I think if I was going to pick someone, I would go for Lacazette.
It seems like quite a modern thing, though, to sort of have a leadership
role. Well, this is the thing.
The captaincy seems more of a symbolic role that I don't think managers take too seriously nowadays.
Was it Liverpool that did Klopp hold the...
Well, Gareth Southgate's obviously got his leadership group for England, and I think Klopp...
He
did the vote, and it was like Wijnaldum came third and then Milner came second.
Yeah, that's the thing. Guardiola's always done this. Like Barcelona, he basically let the players choose the captain. So that in Spain, you tend to have like three or four captains. Like you do have a clear, like someone's a captain, someone's a second, someone's a third, someone's the fourth. And so like there's a hierarchy there. So for example, when Barca were, you know, the peak Barcelona, it was Puyol was captain, then it was Xavi, then it was Iniesta, then it was, I think it was Messi, it was the fourth one. So it's like, and so they had the leadership group. And, you know, all clubs had this. Like at one point, Marcelo was Real Madrid's third captain. Now he's the second, I think, after Ramos. So Emery has brought that over here. Like you said, it's one thing to have the group, and then you have to actually have clear like, who's the captain, because who's the second, who's the third.
I think the major issue is Arsenal is, since last season there was that five, you mentioned it and you were able to name it. I don't think anyone can actually name the perceived group this season.
They got rid of a couple,
didn't they? Everyone left in the previous group, and they've not actually said, right, the new group is. And then people have been forming their own it's almost like factions have been created, and there's people that, there's the Aubameyang leaders clique, people think Lacazette, then there's the people saying just give it to Guendouzi now.
Well that's exactly what I mean. They've got themselves into a problem by naming that leadership group, and then so many of them leaving or being out of form or out of the team. then where do you go from there? If you just have one captain, then he can show the responsibility. If you name five and then none of them are playing,
give it David Luiz.
But Paul Merson said he's a serial winner, so he should have a valid point. It's a valid point.
And he does that, but also no. Well, on the one hand, that's the thing, because he's a bad defender.
Catching is giving away penalties.
but he is. No, you look at it again. He and Aubameyang, for me, most obviously, and Lacazette to a degree, have that sort of personality. Ideally, you want a midfielder to be a captain because they can cover the most area on the pitch and they can always be there to talk to someone and whatever. Because, I mean, I know the idea of the captaincy is kind of outdated.
Why Shaq is captain.
But is, well...
Can't cover the ground.
That's the thing, isn't it? He's shouting for this. Oh, you! But no, it's you know, the idea of a captaincy is kind of overstated now. You know, it's not quite as important, but it is important. There is a definitely an element of I am the leader of the team. So you look at Real Madrid, a great example, right? Because without Ramos is not objectively a world-class defender. As a defender, but as a leader, he is one of the best in the world. He's incredible. So when he plays, he'll make mistakes and he'll lose men, track men. But Madrid as a whole defend way better. Varane, with Ramos and without Ramos, is completely different player, because Ramos is an amazing leader and an organizer. So yes, definitely the idea of the captaincy, the skipper with the armband, is not, you know, there's no more, you know, Terry Butchers running around with bleeding heads. It's not that kind of football anymore, but there is definitely still an idea of leaders, and whether that's become you give it to your best attacking player, which I always thought is kind of weird, because like Sam says, just let them get on with it. But if Aubameyang is really sitting there with Martinelli and saying, hey, how are you doing, speaking in Portuguese and being a welcoming figure, and giving penalties to Pepe so that Pepe can... Maybe there is something to that. Maybe, you know, maybe you just give him the armband. Maybe he'll become a talisman. I mean, he already is.
Yeah, but he's, as I said, he's literally the one saving Arsenal.
Maybe he'll
become
more of a talismanic figure than he already is. And it might grow into it.
Yeah,
you never know. It could work. I mean, Xhaka is not a great... I mean, he's being booed by his own fans, and he's not like a... I don't see him as a great choice to wear the armband, but then, you know,
he's captain of Switzerland, I don't know what he's doing.
Maybe he is really good behind the scenes as well. You just never hear
that's
about
what
it.
I always the only thing with him wearing it at the moment is it's just draws more attention to him when they see the C in brackets. Well, and one, Arsenal fans don't want him in the team at the moment, and when they see the C in brackets, it's like Granit Xhaka, and already that toxicity starts bubbling over. So if Arsenal's problem is the complete lack of an actual captain, which we didn't know until we started recording, is upsetting Sam quite a lot. So he's going to have a 2-minute little break because he doesn't want to think about it anymore. Man United's issues that we flagged at the beginning, despite in the table and some other deeper stats suggesting they're doing okay, there's two issues, really. And it's based on the fact that they've not been able to look like they can break anyone down, a striker and a midfielder. Why are they such glaring issues at the moment, Mo? And
I mean,
will they actually rear their head against?
I mean, you saw regarding midfield, you saw the problem. It's been visible all season. McTominay has been their best performing midfielder, Scott McTominay. Now, I like Scott McTominay. I think he's quite a good. He can be quite a good box to box kind of guy. But they're using him as a six because they don't have another option, and he doesn't have the passing range or the quickness of thought to move the ball quickly. So midfield is not, he's not really an elite defender either. So he's not like shielding the defence with any sort of like, I mean, you know, he's not Jorginho and he's not Makalele. He's neither, you know, he's sort of caught between the two of them, right? He's just an average.
Jack of all trades.
He'd do a job, and I think if you put him between a top class number 6 and number 10, he'd be brilliant, because he'd just be the runner. He'd be like the Darren Fletcher of the legs, right? But there's no Michael Carrick, there's no Paul Scholes now. He's playing with Pogba, who is, you know, either is doesn't look interested half the time, and he's an inconsistent player even when he is interested, let's be fair. Pogba, even when he's really focused on it, he's never a consistent dominant threat throughout the game. That's not how he plays, that's not his style. And United's number 6 options, I mean, Fred, who looks devoid of confidence, Matic, who is just a walking disaster, and I mean, that's it. Andres Pereira can technically play midfield, but he's
been playing quite a lot recently.
Because United don't have anyone else, because of injuries. Like, they've got no one else, and he literally, and I can tell why Solskjaer plays him, because he will run, defend hard, and only give the ball away in the final if they're interested to do anything useful with it. Do you know what I mean? Like, he won't give it away if you're doing something stupid. He'll get to the final third, try and cross it, and mess up. But that's in the final third, and you've got plenty of defenders behind it. So midfield is just not creating chances. They need two midfielders. Like, I mean, you can bring it down to just they need one midfielder, one striker. But really, they need two. They need a defensive midfielder. And I still maintain Ivan Rakitic is the man for them, because he's experienced. No one else in United is. He's a veteran. He's a winner. And he's actually, his weakness at Barcelona, his problem at Barcelona is that Barcelona play passing 3D football. So, and he doesn't really always have his head on a swivel. But what he's great at is shielding the defence and playing very, very impressive long passes, straight passes to cut open defences and find wingers, find fast players. Man United have loads of those. They've got no one to play the passes. Rashford bombing on.
I don't know that many actually left.
Well,
though,
well not right now, but I mean in general, when everyone's fit, Rashford, Greenwood, they've got all these players bombing on, right? So they've got, but they've got no one playing the passes. Mata looks a shadow of someone. I love Mata.
Pogba play the goals against Chelsea. Yeah, when it was like this is OGS.
But that's what
kind
I mean,
of counter attack situations where you only have to.
But that's
I know, but discredit.
But that's the ball.
And that's what I mean about Pogba though. That was one game. Where's he been the rest of the games? You know what I mean?
From open play, chances created, he's created five more than any other Man United player.
Yeah,
with 11.
He's that much better than every other Man United player.
And so he's missed the last two games.
Yeah. No, look, it's but I think if you have someone that can also play as well, it's not just all on Pogba. Because that's the thing. Putting it all on Pogba, he has a sort of, because he's got so much ability, he tries to go into superhero mode and do everything. Which I think is a negative, because then it's like, then you're not playing your role, you're not playing sensible football, you're not playing smart passes. So you have Rakitic in there. Rakitic comes in. I mean, Barcelona tried to sell him in the summer. He's clearly, Valverde is not using him. He's not a mainline starter in his team. I don't think he costs more than 40 million. And he's serial winner, 30 years old, very experienced, 31 years old, very experienced.
Stopgap though, surely, if they bought him.
Well, yeah, but then United need the stopgap because United are bleeding everywhere. They need something to just stop the bleeding,
but
man.
Surely that's been Man United's issue, is being like, oh, there's someone available for 40 million, get him.
Yeah, but
at the
same time,
we might have been saying this about Bastian Schweinsteiger like a few years ago.
Yeah, but then also the thing with Schweinsteiger would have worked if the rest of the team, the thing with the United team before, I don't want to get into that because that was obviously, that team had other problems, which is a lack of mobility, right? You put Schweinsteiger on a team with Wayne Rooney, who's running in that team? You put Rakitic in a team with Rashford and Martial. You can see where the legs are coming from the team. So Rashford, the fact that Rakitic can't necessarily run up the field up and down, that's fine. They need a number 10 as well. And that's possibly even more important than a defensive midfielder right now, because when United get to the final third, they look like they absolutely have no idea what they're doing.
Which is why Arsenal are just going to completely let them off the hook and make them look like the most clinical counter-attacking team in Europe.
Exactly. I mean, you look at Wolves, Southampton, Palace, and even West Ham have made them look utterly clueless. And none of those sides are what I would call great, or, you know, they're okay sides. They're decent Premier League sides. They've made them look absolute. Wolves have been terrible this season. Mm. They've made Man United look clueless. Apart from a wonder goal from Martial, you know, I did really quick. And it's just, and the penalty. Oh God, the penalty. So, you know, because and the problem is United have no pattern of play. You were talking about, you know, Arsenal don't really have a pattern of play. United haven't have anything either. And United don't even have a world-class striker to get away with it. They like, they get to the final third, it's like, wait, what do we do? Mm. Oh no! And it's like, they panic, they freeze. Because, and you know, with a number 10, a top-class number 10, you can cheat not having a pattern of play because the number 10 will create one. Look at Mesut Ozil. Just give him the ball and he'll create something for you. James Maddison, they tried to sign him, or they linked with him early in the summer, then they went calling him, I guess because they were obsessed with getting Maguire, and they figured Leicester were never going to sell them both.
Can we have your two best players, please?
Well, exactly. So I understand, I kind of understand that, but they've got to go back for him. Because, I mean, if everyone's seen that clip of Maddison scoring for Aberdeen during the rounds, wearing red. I mean, you said it in the office yesterday.
White collar as well.
Yeah, is that David Beckham? Yeah. He looked like him, and it was just so. Yeah, they need to go back for Maddison. 100 chances created last season. 48 from set pieces. United have got one set piece assist since Solskjaer took charge. And that even then was like the third. The ball comes in. Chris Smalling heads it. Lindelof heads it down. And then
Lukaku.
Yeah, it wasn't. They've not scored a single goal from a corner since Solskjaer took charge. That's it. That needs to change. That's appalling. And with Maddison in there, you know, you get someone created. But then,
well, he's made such a good start to the season as well. And his little, that goal against Spurs, I think, is going to kick him on. Because one thing said about Maddison, not criticised, but he's got the confidence, isn't it? And that sort of threatens some people
to stand up and take chances and to be, you know. And that's the thing as well, is I think Pogba will really mesh well with him, because Pogba has that confidence too. But Pogba can also often get lost in that confidence, because he's like I can do this easily. And like having someone who also is that good on the team in midfield, not necessarily up front, in the same unit of team as him, also like, oh okay, now we can actually play together and we can create something. Because right now he's so much better than every United midfielder. He just takes all himself. He's like, well, these guys.
Jesse Lingard got an assist against Rochdale. Finally ending his 2019 drought.
I mean, yeah, but now he's to do it in the Premier League. Yeah, yeah.
He's about to return. Oh, he's not returning to his favourite dance.
But look, I mean, look.
No. Oh.
No. Well, no, it's not at Old Trafford. Well, you never know. He might do something. But
he'll be shining his dancing shoes, though.
When it comes to United, look, right. United have had 61 shots this season. That's eighth in the Premier League. 26 of those on target. That's ninth. They've scored 8 goals. That's 10th. They're basically, they're shooting like a mid-table side. So it makes sense that they are mid-table. I mean, the problem is that up front, you mentioned striker midfield. Midfield, obviously, striker is they had no one. They sold Lukaku, and okay, fine, he didn't fit the team, but they had no one else apart from Martial who can play with their back to goal.
Lukaku did fit the team because he scored. Yeah, I still think that was all of a mixture of Lukaku didn't want to be there, and also as well, again, with this, some performances, it made sense to sell him, but.
Yeah.
Let's be honest.
If you're going
in the FA Cup game against Arsenal, Lukaku played right wing and set up two of the goals and was key to Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's counter-attacking team.
Yeah.
And then saved them in Paris as well, scoring goals on the break.
If United, I thought United were going to commit to a full-on counter-attacking side. I was like, okay, I get it. I mean, you can still keep Lukaku, but I get it. He doesn't really want to be there, and he is he's a big guy. He does get a bit tired running the break constantly. But United have played. Only really one game like that this season against Chelsea. Otherwise, they've had the balls. Like, Lukaku would have been great here because he can just nip in, score some goals. He's great. He rescued. I mean, you say Paris, but I think Palace before that game was the most illustrative chance because United were awful in that game. And
he scored three goals in three games in a row.
And very, very, very strikery goals as well. The kind of goals that Rashford can't score, which is the big problem United have. Rashford is a very, again, he's the Dothraki. He's on the open field, lethal, not so good when it's closed up. Martial can be good closed up, but Martial's been injured since like the second game of the season. Greenwood is phenomenal in small spaces, very, very quick feet, very good on the foot, but he's 17. He can't go a whole season. He won't. He'll lose form. He'll get hurt. He's 17. It's not going to happen. So that United need a striker. And even more so midfield, they could do with a stopgap here. And I think there's only one man that can save them. And it's Zlatan Ibrahimovic. He's smashing their MLS pieces.
The lion returns.
Look, all right. The last time Man United were good, the only real time Man United looked like Man United since Ferguson left was when Zlatan was at the club. And it was like, Mourinho. I think it was Zlatan that was imparting that mentality onto everyone else. And Mourinho played him every game and he got tired and got injured and stopped playing well. But that first 6 months, maybe it was, where he was fit. Oh, my days. And he doesn't have to run because everyone else in United can run. They just can't stand still in the box and play with their back to goal. And all the things Zlatan can do, United need someone to do. All the things Zlatan can't do, United have people to do it all day long. You know, to me, it makes perfect sense. He's not going to cost that much.
So Man United's another stopgap, though.
So Man United's January transfer strategy is a 30-year-old Ivan Rakitic who is finished by all accounts. Sometimes that you've said. Maybe you just finished for Barcelona.
Finishing that style of football.
And 38-year-old.
United need experience, but that's the thing.
And I know Ibrahimovic is a medical marvel.
Yes.
I can't believe he is still playing, but...
Well, I mean, if you want to be a bit younger, you could go for Hwang Hee-chan from Salzburg. Everyone was going crazy about Erling Haaland without noticing the fact that all of his goals came because he was running off Hwang Hee-chan, who was playing a really, really smart, really sensible attacking role, 23-year-old Korean forward. I mean, you want to get someone who's a bit younger, the target man role for Rashford, for Martial, get him. He scored, I think, 4 goals in 6 games so far in Austrian Bundesliga. So he's a younger player who could do it. But
he's not young and British.
No, but I mean, Rashford, Zlatan to me is the one because he's just a leader. I mean, yeah, it's a short-term thing, but you know, I need a short-term boost because right now...
Like, short-term boost, just to quickly round up this section... How long can it go on before a change is made, do you think, managerially? Or is it just get through this season?
Yeah, I think unless he drifts out of touching distance of the top six dramatically, he's got the whole season. I mean, excluding Solskjaer's running total, the average number of games given to Man United managers since Alex Ferguson's down is 99. Solskjaer's yet to even surpass David Moyes' total of competitive games in this respect, which interestingly, he will, I think, either level or surpass when Manchester United play Everton in December. David Moyes' derby, of course. And so basically, that's one reason. I don't think he's been given enough time for Manchester United to maintain this perception of having pivoted towards long-term thinking.
Video.
That's such an interesting joke. So that's one reason. I think Manchester United will sort of expose themselves as hypocrites somewhat if they sack a manager without having given him as many games as they gave David Moyes. Because David Moyes was sacked at a point where the standards were much higher. What we've seen is like a gradual lowering of the bar a Manchester United manager has to stay above to stay in the job. And obviously, like I said, right now they're in the long-term planning stage of the traditional club decline trajectory.
Which will be solved by Rakitic and Ibrahimovic.
Yeah, well, I mean,
the pillars of it.
Well, no, I think
that's unfair. Sorry,
because there's criticisms to be made of the manager. In that maybe he wasn't the right person. I've said before they hired him at a moment, and this is part of the problem is that so much of their strategy seems, because obviously we don't have inside information, seems to just be driven by a desire to appease fans and maintain morale among them. So they hired him, a club legend, at a point where they had a series of winnable games to boost morale. Solskjaer won the games, even exceeded expectations, it must be said. And then they bought into that hype.
Oh, no.
And then, so they create, they're now in a trap of their own creation, like the Wile E. Coyote of football clubs, basically. And they've got to kind of stick with it now, because to sack Solskjaer would contradict the stated aims of this project. And also other parts of the project, which is like this sort of, it feeds into this nostalgic yearning among certain fans for like young British talent, which United became famous for with the class of 92, of course. Also this counter-attacking a style of play which is known as the United way from the old Fergie days, which is totally right, because fans obviously like feed off these memories, and that's what makes Manchester United such a special club. But it seems like they've just bought into they've taken that too central into the thinking of the strategy that they have in the club. And the problem with that is that A, it's not really fans' job to dictate policy in the way that they've kind of, it seems they've inadvertently done, at least on the surface level. And B, fans are fickle and emotion led. And if you're sort of, if all the moves you're making are an attempt to maintain positive emotions among fans, then it's all well and good, but results are ultimately the thing that that can maintain,
it's like Chelsea
positive emotions
without the trophies.
I mean, I would agree with that, everything you say there, but I would also add that they haven't gone far enough into the idea, because the whole point of, like, I agree with you, they've bought into this idea that we have to recreate old United, 99 United, and so on and so forth, which, okay, fine, but then they haven't backed Solskjaer enough, because to do that you need
They broke their
transfer record. They did back him. They bought a £55 million fullback and an £85 million centre back in this window. That's backing for that
time.
That is,
but United needed more. That's
know,
the thing.
The
squad needed
they
more.
You can't get £500 million of players when they've got their one asset to sell was Lukaku. They sold him. That was to pay for Maguire.
Yeah.
It's naive to think that they could have got James Maddison, Declan Rice, Harry Maguire, Wan-Bissaka.
No.
All £60 million each in that window.
I'm not saying they could have got those players, but that's the thing. That's the limited range of their thinking. Like, I mean, I mentioned Hwang Hee-chan. Like, why not scout someone like that? Why is it always the Southamptons that scout
players?
Why not
watch the first game of the Champions League this season?
I'm just saying. No, United have a much bigger scouting network than I do.
Yes.
So it's like, don't sell
yourself short, mate.
So why don't they? You know, with all their infinite resources, actually do some scouting, not just look at the most obvious players. Look, Declan Rice, very good.
Yeah.
Sean Longstaff, very good. But you could find someone that's.
I agree. I think he was backed sufficiently, but I also do agree with the point you made, kind of about Zlatan. It seems like they don't have the sort of peak years.
They've built
so
long.
Zlatan's not peak years, but they don't have the peak years.
They've looked so much for long term. They've forgotten completely about short term, basically.
Well, they're lurching between the two, because when they initially sacked Mourinho, they made a real big point of saying, we're going to take our time with this.
Mm-hmm.
Solskjaer's going to come in interim, and then we'll decide in the summer. And then they instantly went back on that within six games. Which is why I think it's worrying that they're making a really big point at the moment of stressing that it's all about long term, because I think that a switch is about to come.
Yeah.
Because if they had waited till the end of the season and hadn't given it to Solskjaer, it would have been pretty easy at that point to say, sorry, you haven't done enough. But they couldn't resist. Like
just
you say,
keep him,
like you said, Will.
What
they
we said when he was even being hired, just keep him as the super sub that you keep bringing in. Use him as your good hitting.
Yeah. That's it. Good show.
Because so say they hadn't hired Solskjaer, then they probably could have got Pochettino, who they wanted long term
soon anyway.
The fee they'll have to pay to prize him away from Daniel Levy might be a somewhat lower.
Yeah. But we've spoken plenty on Man United and gone beyond the game and into their issues, and we don't want to dive too far into that, because after the break, there's a more important game in Spain. Y ahora el partido más importante del fin de semana, el derbi madrileño. What an intro for Spain. I went Spanish. For anyone that doesn't speak Spanish, the most important game of the weekend is probably the Madrid derby, actually, despite us giving a lot of time to the Man United game. Serious things up for grabs. Madrid, whatever happens, and there are games being played tonight before we, after we record, Madrid will be first. 14 points. Atletico Madrid at the moment are second. So all of a sudden, Real Madrid, who were in crisis, and we said they were rubbish against PSG, are sitting pretty at the top of La Liga. Is it going to last, Mike?
Who knows, honestly. I mean, they hadn't... when they went top or went ahead of Barcelona ages ago, it was like the first time in 800 days or something they've been ahead of Barcelona on the table. So it's like...
Are you counting?
Just something I read on Twitter, mate. No, look, it's the interesting thing with Madrid because you look at their goals last night from two teenage Brazilians, very nice. Both of them were kind of worldies. They didn't like create like what you would call like a normal goal, like an easy sort of chance. Like, oh yeah, that's obviously they beat Russell, and they created these easy chances. Stunning goal from Vinicius, and then Rodrigo comes on for his debut, pulls a 40-yard pass out of the sky, runs into the box, skips by his man, puts it in the back of the net. It's a really, really good goal. Amazing goal.
Stat alert. According to Mr. Chip, legend that is Mr. Chip, Rodrigo broke a David Beckham record by scoring 95 seconds into his La Liga debut. The record being, from what I can gather, the quickest goal scored on a debut.
Fastest
game.
Goal, whatever.
Yeah.
On a debut. So,
yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, and it was amazing.
Continue.
No. Thank you. No, it was very good, but neither of those goals, they didn't create them through their normal means. Like, there was no crosses. I mean, they've scored the most headed goals, I think, in top five leagues, like 9 headed goals.
Benzema's got the most in 2019.
That's what I was saying, at the weekend when they beat Sevilla in the Ramon Sánchez Pizjuán, the first time since Zidane was a player that they've done that. The first time they've won 1-0 there anyway. That was a header. That was a lovely, lovely classic Real Madrid header. Carvajal pingy back cross. Benzema rising, headed it back across goal. Lovely goal. They were somewhat fortunate to win that game. That probably a draw would have been the fair result there, but they played very well. Mm. And you know, Osasuna at home is usually an easy-ish win. Like, you tend to win that game. But again, it's the interesting thing. Benzema, of course, has 5 goals in 5 games. Top goal scorer in La Liga. Last season, he had 21 and 36 La Liga games. He scores in streaks. He doesn't score in massive volumes. I mean, he still scores, still gets it done, but he's not like...
Only Messi and Mbappe have more in 2019.
Yeah, he's been in very good form this year, this calendar year. You wonder, like, I mean, obviously I touted him to be like, he's going to have a Rooney-esque season, I said at the start of last season, and then he didn't. He didn't do too badly in the end.
He did. He scored more than Ronaldo in the end, didn't he?
Well, yeah. No, he definitely did. And it's the thing, though. I like Benzema a lot, but he's an inconsistent goal scorer in big games. I mean, he didn't really show up against Ajax, for instance, when they got turfed out the Champions League. So you wonder how long he can keep this up. Can he pick up niggles, little ninjuries here and there? Luka Jovic hasn't really shown to be favoured by Zidane that much at all. Played yesterday, but, you know, had a goal read out by VAR. I don't know, because Madrid, I think you said that what they're overperforming their XG by quite a considerable way.
No, they're not overperforming. This is where you've misread. So I was waiting, and now you've passed the baton. Real Madrid... not sustainable. They've created the most chances in the La Liga this season by about 20. They have the highest expected goals in the La Liga at the moment. And they also have the largest, expected goals differential. Right. So, surely, Real Madrid La Liga champions.
I mean,
so far, so good.
It's been impressive. I said, let's see, though, because the big thing with Madrid is, I mean, look, you saw how ordinary they were against PSG. Really got torn to bits. They've had a relatively easy start to the season. No massive troubling fixtures. Sevilla away notwithstanding.
Sevilla away is a place they've not won for a few years.
That's what I was saying.
Well.
The last time they've won there
I think the encouraging thing about that game as well is the performance of James Rodriguez. I think he got like man of the match.
He was good, yeah.
He's been hailed for like demonstrating more maturity, more defensive work. And if you look at him and Gareth Bale, who they were looking to for goals earlier on in the season. That's two players who are potentially world class in kind of their peak years, just like boosting that squad. which actually looks a lot more healthy when you've got players like that performing. And Cruz was quite good, I thought, against Osasuna last night, created a lot of chances, nearly scored a couple of worldies himself.
Yeah, it was the interesting thing about when, because they brought Fede Valverde into the midfield yesterday. And I think what the interesting thing is obviously Cruz's ability on the ball has never been questioned. Yeah. It's just the fact that he's very, very easily played around off it.
Yeah.
And obviously they've passed their reliance on Luka Modric and Casemiro to bail him out, and they did to a degree, especially in being able to be champions, not consistently over season. Now Casemiro isn't at the level he was before. Luka Modric definitely isn't at the level he was before. So it's like, how do you do it? And Fede Valverde offers a lot of energy and offers a lot of counterbalance to Cruz, gives Cruz a lot more license to run forward. And he is a 10. He's not really a 6. He's not really even an 8. He's a 10. He's an attacking midfielder. So you unleash Cruz as an attacking threat, maybe that can be a sort of tipping point and get you.
Cruz strikes me now as a player that much prefers to have the game in front of him, though, which you don't get if you play as a number 10.
Yeah,
so he's good to have just at the base pinging.
He's created the most chances, I think, or second most chances in the Liga, and Casemiro is doing what Casemiro does and making the most tackles in the Liga. A couple more points on their team. Obviously they've got issues at left back for this Atletico game with Marcelo potentially ruled out, but also Ferland Mendy, who's impressed himself during early stages of this season. Last season, he was praised for his ability in one-on-one situations. And last season, I looked into this, and he was one of only two Ligue 1 defenders to make at least 40 tackles and dribbles last season. I think he was up against Navas and Ocampos in the Sevilla game.
Yeah, they gave him a bit of a tough time, but he acquitted himself.
It was a tough
well.
Test, but and then kept a clean sheet. So that's impressive.
Which they hadn't done since. Well, Courtois hadn't done since February.
So when he's fit, that could, you know, sort of address the issue at left back with Marcelo in decline. I think Nacho is the stand-in left back otherwise.
Nacho's just Nacho Real Madrid's Callum Chambers.
And then the other area of concern that we talked about after the PSG game was Courtois. And I don't know if Areola performed amazingly in last night's game, but this is the one-handed catch.
It's stunning.
Which, if you haven't seen, check it out. I have a little Twitter search for that one because it's just so unnecessarily cool.
And then Areola's the coolest goalkeeper because he's the one that's got the gif of him drop kicking the crossbar.
Yeah.
To stretch out before a game. Meanwhile, PSG losing at home 2-0.
To Rennes.
And apparently Navas didn't cover himself in glory there.
Yeah.
So how things change in a week of football?
I mean, this is the thing. There's a long way to go in La Liga. So Real Madrid so far so good. They've not really had any massive test problems. Sevilla at home, obviously. Sevilla away. So let's see what happens. I just want to see how it goes because obviously they've got a lot of factors. But the thing is, one thing we haven't mentioned yet is if Eden Hazard, once Eden Hazard, he looks very, 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 very short of fitness right now. But once Eden Hazard gets up to speed, that could be a very big tipping point for Madrid because he is, as we've said before, very good at football.
Isco is ruled out at the moment.
Isco and James are kind of a muchness in terms of what they bring to the team, though. And I think one thing is Zidane might have accidented his way into another great squad like he did in 2016-17.
This is what I was going to say.
He basically didn't want James, didn't want Isco at the time.
Didn't want Bale.
And, you know, and then because of Bale's injury, Isco went to the first team, but he had James and just playing in this rotation. You could rotate the entire team and James and Bale would play and it's crazy. So he's basically accident. He didn't want Bale. He didn't want James. He's been forced to have them. And he sort of accidented his way into having another very, very deep squad now all of a sudden. I don't know.
Potentially the best in the league.
But then he deserves praise though if he didn't want them, but then they're back and he manages to still get the best out of
them. Zidane's great skill is his man management is exemplary. It's really quite something. And that's the thing, he can keep a lot of superstars happy. Not for loads of seasons, but for one season, he'll keep them happy enough to win things. So it could be interesting to watch them develop over the season. They do have a very big shortness in midfield, though. I mean, I know that we just said Fede Valverde helped Toni Kroos, but literally, beyond those three...
Well, there were no midfielders on... We were speaking about just before we left the office yesterday, we saw the team. There were no midfielders on the bench.
I think Modric is back in training now. Let's switch to Atletico then quickly as well.
As I said, they're second. And we said before we started the podcast about every time we say Atletico Madrid are going to bloody win La Liga, they seem to be struggling. But again, they're second. And obviously 7-3 in pre-season this game was.
Yeah.
So let's hope that happens again. But one thing that I just wanted to highlight when I was looking through the stats of it, Atletico Madrid have actually had the fewest crosses from open play in La Liga this season, which is surprising given they've got Kieran Trippier in the team. But they've created the most chances from set pieces. So Simeone obviously not using it as much as an outlet as you would think. But in the key moments from those set pieces, I remember Sam spoke about it in their Champions League game with Trippier delivering the ball in for their equaliser.
They've gone back to basics. This is how they originally became really good. They're solid defensively, they create chances from set pieces, and they score goals. Like the title winning goal in 2014, well, it was a draw at the Camp Nou, but essentially the title winning goal they scored, set piece. The goal that took the lead from the Champions League final that year, set piece. The goal they scored, the Copa del Rey winning goal 2013, set piece.
The goal they beat Real Madrid with at the weekend, set piece?
I mean, let's see.
That voice was high.
Let's see.
The intonation
because,
for the question.
Because Sergio Ramos, and again, is going to play that game. And as I said before, Ramos and Varane, when they're together, it's a completely different whole thing. But, yeah, I mean, look.
Diego Costa ended his drought. João Félix has started very well.
Yes, scored a goal yesterday. I mean, big, big deflection, but scored but nonetheless.
I've seen a lot of praise of the way he's been applying himself in the games, not just the goal scoring.
Yeah, and his dribbling is quite something as well. So that's the big problem, I think, for Real Madrid's going to be because they're going to push up. They'll let them have the ball. And so what that means that João Félix is going to be counterattacking against Real Madrid in space. I've said a million times, Casemiro can't defend space to save his life.
And this is the thing as well. You said about the mobility of Cruz and stuff. Atletico Madrid's midfield with Saúl and
very mobile.
They're famous for not giving you a second. Yeah. So Cruz won't get any time, and it could be a good time. Obviously, that's at the Wanda Metropolitano.
Yeah, and the big thing,
well.
The big thing that usually decided this game was Cristiano Ronaldo, who has the secret sauce to beating Atletico Madrid. Yeah. He's not playing for Real Madrid. He's not going to be there.
Well, yeah.
Benzema's going to be interesting to watch. Hazard as well. Because Hazard, of course, famously did very well for Chelsea against Atletico Madrid. Helped them beat them in the Wanda?
Yeah, it was only the second Champions League home defeat. It was the first defeat at the Wanda.
At the Wanda. So, you know, so Hazard has form against Atletico Madrid. So let's see what happens there. But
the person who scored in that game, Morata will not be playing in the Morata derby.
Yes.
Because... got sent off after 11 minutes of coming on.
I don't know what's going on. But look, Costa's found form, and that's the big thing.
I think Costa scored about six of those seven goals in the preseason game, so he's going to be up for it.
Speaking of players that love Real Madrid, love playing in this derby, he loves playing Real Madrid. He made Rafa around like an amateur in that preseason game. So he's incredible. And look, one thing Atletico Madrid are missing, because they're not storing as many goals as they should be, is they're missing... I mean, it's quite... explanatory, easy, really. They're missing Antoine Griezmann. He created the most chances last season with 74, created the most big chances with 13, and he's not there now. So they're having to reorient the entire, we can't just give it to Griezmann anymore.
Yeah.
And he was always great in the derby as well.
And despite Felix getting the number seven, they are
very
applying
different
it in a different
he's
way.
He's a goal scorer. He's a scoring player.
I also think he's actually more of a Simeone player than we potentially gave credit for, the way he's applied himself. So. Yeah. He's going to be really interesting. It's obviously his first Madrid derby, Hazard's first Madrid derby, if he does play.
1-1
so we'll look
seems
out
plausible.
For that. There
maybe,
you go.
Maybe.
We'll give Mo the prediction rights on that one. But we're going to take a quick break. And then the final piece of today's podcast will be something a bit more evergreen. And we're going to be looking at our ultimate Squawker 6 FIFA Pro 11 team. So it is indeed the return of Squawker 6. We have not done one in a while, but we realised that they're fun to do. And we've picked this week based on what was a surprising FIFA Pro 11, which, remember, is voted for by the players solely.
I think media representatives, captains. And
not on FIFA Pro 11. That's what I'm saying. That's the difference. FIFA Pro 11 is the FIFA Pro and it's just players. Whereas the best, that's why FIFA Pro 11 and Mbappe was in. But then when the top 10 for the best, Salah and Mane were above him, because that's when the media votes go in, because everyone was voting for Salah for some reason. Whereas Mbappe is the true third best attacker in FIFA Pro. But, exactly, already causing contention, even within our definitions. So, what we did was, we went back, 2005 FIFA Pro 11 started from, Squawker 6 is picking a goalkeeper, a fullback, a centre-back, a centre-midfielder, a winger and a forward. So essentially two forwards given how the thing works, but that is the case. And you have to pick the year, not just a player, so you can't just say Messi as your forward. We're picking the year in which they featured in the World 11. So, for example, you can have 2014 X and 2009 Y in your team. And the way we'll do this is we'll just go around with each pick, position by position, and then we'll discuss the most contentious ones, because we might all have exactly the same, and then it'll be really easy and we can finish early. But for some reason, I don't think that's going to be the case. So, Sam, starting with you, your FIFA Pro 11 score was 6, and I realise we made that so confusing by doing 6 of an 11, but that's what we're doing. Two numbers in it, doesn't matter. Goalkeeper, year and player, please.
Casillas, 2008.
Will?
2014, Manuel Neuer.
2012, Iker Casillas.
Oh, so two Casillas and two Manuel Neuer, because I've also picked 2014 Manuel Neuer.
That's because Ole Hoeneß told us we had to.
Yeah. if we didn't pick him, he'd never let us talk about Bayern Munich players on the podcast ever again. I didn't go for 2016 Neuer. I don't think he got it then anyway, but he was tie wearer of the year that year. Oof. So that was, you might want to use him for that. Casillas. Casillas. Let's start with you, Mo, first, 2012.
He didn't concede any goals in the knockout rounds of the Euro. I think he conceded one or two goals overall in the whole tournament. This is Casillas basically at his peak-ish. I mean, well, you could argue he maybe was better in 2010, but I'm doing a thing where I'm only picking one player per year. I'm not like doubling
up. Mo added his own rule. Let's make it more difficult. Let's just get that out
there. That's why I just want to make it more difficult. Otherwise, it'd just be all 2010, 2011. But anyway, so...
According to you.
According to me, in my opinion. That's just like my opinion, man. That's another film reference, by the way.
You know they're lost on us. Mo's tried about seven of those off there, and they're all been cut out because no one gets them.
Big Lebowski. Anyway, so I went because he has 2012. I was thinking Neuer 2014, but I thought someone else was going to pick him, and of course,
two of us did. Sam, why have you gone for a different Casillas?
That was the first year he was in it, taken over from Buffon. And he was so good then when Spain were sort of at the peak of their powers.
So you just, the changing of the guard tipped it over.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think we've all kind of gone for international reasons. Mine were all sort of World Cup based. I remember him being such an entertaining sweeper keeper at the World Cup that year. I think it was the game against Algeria that was the biggest one.
Yeah.
And also, I looked into this.
Dangerous.
You might be surprised to hear he actually made 8 saves in the 7-1 win over Brazil. So if Germany hadn't had a goalkeeper for that game, it might have been a different result.
And only Tim Howard made more saves in the World Cup, and I'm pretty sure all of them came in that famous game where I think he set the record for most saves in a single World Cup game.
Neuer was like the reason, by the way, that Germany first off drew with Ghana. They were going to lose to Ghana. He plays very well, and he's the reason they beat Algeria. Algeria were better than Germany in that game and would have knocked them out, but he made loads of great saves. So
if you do a score search of Neuer 2014, and so I was flicking between 2013 and 2014 Neuer.
Champions League winning.
Because I went for 2014 in the end, just for those for the World Cup. And I think he came third in the Ballon d'Or that year, which is impressive for a goalkeeper. And I know that's just waiting the Ballon d'Or.
Casillas also won the league in 2012. That's the reason. But that gives him a bit of advantage. But I went 2012 because he and of course I think also one thing is the humanitarian element in the final. They're winning 4-0 against Italy, and the referee's like, "Oh, 3 added minutes." He's like, "Ref, please blow the whistle. Respect for Italy. We're winning 4-0." Which I thought was a nice classy touch from a classy guy.
Cut the mic.
Mo's putting Casillas in for being nice.
A classy guy, who refused to engage in Jose Mourinho's total war and as a result lost his place in the Real Madrid team. Didn't lose his place because he stopped playing well.
He's a martyr. We set Mo off with this question. I didn't realise. Iker Casillas gets in for being a martyr. An incredible goalkeeper. So that, already a good start. Only me and you are the same in terms of year and player, but two Casillas. Next, we go on to fullback. Sam, we'll go around and start with you again.
Dani Alves, 2015.
Dani Alves, 2011.
Yeah, Dani Alves, 2011 is the correct answer.
So
I literally got down here. I went with Dani Alves because Mo told me this was his best year.
Yeah,
and I think he's just slightly better than Philip Lahm in terms of.
I picked Dani Alves, and then my note was ask Mo which year was the best.
Look, you could have picked 2009. He missed the final through suspension. So, he's very good.
So I put 2009 in the end because I didn't want to actually ask you. Read an article by Sid Lowe. I found an article saying that Dani Alves was the second best player in the world.
Yep.
In that year,
Footballing Sonic the Hedgehog.
And it was a really good read. So I just thought, I'm going to go 2009, despite the fact, as you said, he missed the final.
I mean, if he missed the final, but the cross that led to Iniesta's famous goal against Chelsea came from Dani Alves. A sensational cross. He gets the ball played to him by Piqué. He's about like 40 yards from goal on the right touchline. He just pings this amazing thing in, which just about gets cleared, I think, by John Terry. And then it falls to Messi. And then Messi infamously miskicked it. Messi controlled it, Iniesta goal. So...
Alves doesn't get any credit there.
Not to the final assist, which actually means
if he doesn't ping that in, though, he doesn't get another. But 2011 is the best Alves because he was at his most dominant that season. He had the most assists in a league. I can't remember the exact number, but he was just incredibly. I mean, he's a midfielder, he's a defender. Mm.
That's why I picked him.
He's a bit of everything. He's the best fullback of all time, basically. With respect to Cafu and Jaume Santos,
because obviously you could have picked a 2005 Cafu in this.
Yeah, but that was his first year.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. It's like I was looking for names first, and then I was like, right, is that good enough? Because when we get onto the forwards,
Maldini probably is the best fullback as defender. But
well, this is the thing: you've got people like Maldini and Nesta as well in these decisions.
Maldini scored 2005. Maldini did score in the final, but then also
conceded three goals.
Yeah. So you know,
against blooming Liverpool of all teams, Sam. Reasons in particular why you went for a later edition of Dani Alves.
2015, I said, wasn't it? So that's when they beat Juve in the Champions League final.
Yeah.
I just think he's got so much. I like him more as he's got older. I didn't used to like him that much when he was younger. I don't know, it was sort of arrogance thing, but this guy is too much.
Season was pretty good fun because he basically his contract was running out at the end of the year. Barca weren't going to renew it. He wasn't playing well, and like he kept thinking they'd renew it, and then it got to like March, and like then they weren't going to renew it. So like right, so he played out of his mind the last 2 months of that season to basically as good as he ever played, but only for those last 2 months just to sort of force they renewed his contract.
So Sam's choosing 2 months of that year.
Essentially, starting at half time of the Clásico win over Real Madrid.
There you go. Well. So Dani Alves in agreement and slightly different years just for a bit of fun, but I think we all agree that, as Mo said, you can argue that Dani Alves is one of the greatest fullbacks of all time, so definitely worthy of his place in our Squawk Sits FIFA Pro 11. Moving on to centre back next, I don't think anyone's going to pick 2014 David Luiz, which when you look back at 2014 team is bizarre. Sam?
I went for Maldini 2005.
This is my most basic bro shout, but I've gone for 2006 Fabio Cannavaro.
Well, I was going to go for 2006 Cannavaro, but you know what? That's boring, so let's mix it up. Let's be interesting. Let's be really interesting. Let's say...
It's not about being interesting, Mo.
You're deciding on the spot, and that's not what we asked you to do.
Let's say...
You should have this now.
2010 Carlos Puyol.
I went for 2005 John Terry in this.
That's a good shout. That's
controversy of... person, but as a player, obscene. And obviously Van Dijk was the first defender to win PFA Player of the Year since him in that season. In 2004-05 season, so I know it starts, but I've considered this. Chelsea conceded 15 goals.
Yeah.
And they've conceded 13 this season.
Yeah.
He was in the FIFA Pro World 11 four seasons in a row.
Yeah. And I
think he's also, because we were looking into English players last time they was in it, I think the answer was it was 2009 when they had John Terry, Steven Gerrard in it, and that's the last one in John Terry's four seasons.
So I was looking for when I was looking through this, and when you look through these FIFA Pro 11s, you're like, oh my words, there have been some really obscenely good footballers, as you'd expect. But I was trying to think, and again it's what I know the most. Premier League football is what I've watched the most of, and John Terry, as I said, as a player, even when playing out from the back or long balls from the back, what he used to do with his left foot, which I think he literally trained his left foot to hit 60 yard diagonal passes, and despite being right footed with everything else,
he was
so good. And then to give my opinion validation, I just looked for a stat, and it was just that 2004-05 season, 25 clean sheets in a Premier League season, like 15 goals conceded. As I said, like Watford have conceded more and conceded more than half of that in one game against Man City. So I used that to validate John Terry, and again, he was voted best player in the Premier League by his peers that season. So That was why he was my choice. Cannavaro, because of World Cup.
Yeah. Centre-backs aren't just memorable. I was going to say,
is that why
this was like Italy, Catenaccio winning them the World Cup, basically. It wasn't really their goal scoring at that tournament.
Yeah, so I would... Actually, let me rephrase. Pre-2009, not 2010, just because I want to keep my one-per-year rule. 2009, look, he was amazing leader. Guardiola's first season, he really held it all together. He scored a staggeringly good goal against Real Madrid, Santiago Bernabeu in the 6-2. Really, really wonderful header. Just the immaculate leader. Played right back in the final because of suspensions and injuries. Played it really well. Just an all-round good guy. You know, attends goats in the off-season, has a farm. Literally, you know, proper working class hero.
Mo's managing to find a non-footballing reason for each of his inclusions as well.
That's what I'm saying.
You're backing every single choice.
Puyol's one of the last working class heroes in football. Truly elite players, I should say.
And that's why he's in your score is six. Sam, Maldini, pourquoi?
Purely just because he's the sort of last member of the old school that's in any of these 11. So,
and that made up quote about tackling. Sam's got that tattooed on his back. But again, as I said, when you pick those players, and as Mo said, despite conceding three in the final, he did actually score at the beginning. But when you look at, when I was seeing Nesta and Maldini, I was like, how am I arriving to a decision where those fabled great Italian defenders are not my pick?
But I think that goal is the fastest ever scored in the Champions League final, or I can't confirm.
It was at the time. I don't know if it still is. I'm pretty sure it still is, right? I'm scoring.
We'll find that out. We can't tell you because we've got to move on to midfielder, which was again so difficult. And I didn't want
this is the easiest one.
I know it would be easy for you, but I didn't. I was, this is all personal and sort of like what I like and what I have memories of.
True.
Rather than trying to be completely objective, because I think it's impossible.
Yeah.
So it's almost romantic. Sam, which midfielder did you...
In that case then, Gerrard in 2009.
Yes!
Yeah, I went for Gerrard.
We'll celebrate Gerrard being picked. Like, that doesn't tell you everything you need to know about Liverpool.
I think he's definitely my blind spot for remaining objective.
Two Gerrards.
Xavi Hernandez in 2010 won the Liga, won the World Cup. Just the best midfielder in the world.
Remember I said, everyone says their pick first and then we go into reasoning.
Xavi Hernandez Cruz.
I went for Kaká.
Yeah, because I watched this one.
Because I watched his goals against Man United. and in terms of...
So that's 2007 Kaká.
Sorry. Yeah. 2007 Kaká is my midfielder. Lampard was only in it once. And I said when we were doing this off air, I said Lampard is the most difficult player retrospectively to look at because he scored so many goals.
He took the spot that rightfully should have been Steven Gerrard.
Kaká that season Champions League had 10 goals, top scorer, amazing goal against Celtic in extra time, battered United twice, one assist in the final against Liverpool. So really, really strong performance.
I just think amid, and again, I know he sometimes even played up front, but as sort of
he played the tip of a diamond.
Yeah, tip of a diamond. But I just, the dribbling is like my...
Yeah,
I love players that can carry the ball. I love players that can carry the ball, and I don't think you get many of them from midfield anymore. Anyway, so he wasn't just arriving late in the box to get on the end of the ball. He was the one bringing the ball into the box, and that goal where he sort of pokes his head in between the two Man United defenders, and they clash into each other,
and no longer the biggest swap of all time, thanks to Felipe Coutinho. Kaká is now number two, so good for him.
In 2007, he was by far obviously won the Ballon d'Or. As well. It looks like I've nearly just picked Ballon d'Or winners, but
So Xavi for me, as I said, won the World Cup, dominated the whole tournament, 97 passes in the final. Just the whole tournament was shaped by him. Won La Liga, second La Liga in a row. Just won the Champions League the year before, won the Champions League the year after. Unlucky not to win it this year. Just absolutely incredible. Changed world football. Changed what a midfielder is supposed to be. Everyone wants a passing player now. The idea of a rampaging ball like Steven Gerrard has gone out of fashion almost. It's like the all of football is sort of, oh yeah, Xavi, he's really good. I mean, look, Leon Britton and Joe Allen and the Wandsworth Xavi and the Welsh Xavi.
I think it was just Welsh Xavi, but I don't think it's as good as you remembered it.
No, it's not.
Gerrard fan club.
Yeah, I think this is off the back of kind of the 2008-09 season, 17 goals, 4-1 Old Trafford, force of nature.
Kissing the camera, not the title.
Yeah,
he was so good that season.
Yeah, this is when he was like just playing as almost second striker to Torres for quite a lot of season.
Honestly,
theme is, and I know Xavi like didn't score many goals, but even with like goalkeepers, we've said me and Will have picked the one that was the furthest to the opposition goal, because when you try and look back, and obviously we haven't had a month to prepare this entire list, you do get sort of drawn to those stats, and that's why I said Lampard is will only get better in people's mind as time goes on, because you look just down his list of career goals in a season and it's like, wow, this guy is obviously good.
Until Messi and Cristiano started doing it, like, I think there was a period where only David Villa was as consistent as Lampard as scoring more than 20 goals in a season.
While I was doing this, I was looking at goal scorers per year.
Yeah.
Transfer Market, you can do it and just by domestic games, like Cup, Champions League and League. Harry Kane obviously scored that 49 in 2017, which was level with Messi. Yeah. The last person to beat Ronaldo and Messi was Edin Dzeko in like 2009 for Wolves, when he was absolutely killing it.
That Wolfsburg with Dzeko and Graffiti was quite a team.
So I was going to put Dzeko in, but he didn't get into a FIFA 11 somehow. With that, we move on to the winger or just wide forward. It can just be anyone. This is the one where essentially we expect two names to be said, but I don't want to forecast too openly. So what have you got in iteration for your winger or wide forward?
I've got Ronaldo 07.
Will?
I've got 2008 Ronaldo.
Interesting.
Okay. Well, no, I'm joking. Cristiano Ronaldo 2017.
So now I feel like I've done something wrong, because this is where I've put 2012 Lionel Messi as my winger.
Ooh, you've probably just done it opposite to us, basically. Well, I mean, opposite to me anyway.
Because 2012, Radamel Falcao was your centre forward. So I thought Messi was I put him as my wide forward there.
Yeah. I remember reading your piece the other day, and it was like Lionel Messi was playing as the sort of false nine in the middle.
False nine, 2012, yeah.
Yeah, I literally just went on the picture of the FIFA Pro 11 and picked the person wide.
That's fair.
Because as we know, and as well to explain the FIFA Pro ranking, it's not, you don't get picked as a winger, you get put as a forward, and then it's the top three picked. So for this one, as I said, depending how sort of literal to the rule you want it to be, you could just pick any of the people in the three forwards in any of the pitches. Yeah. So this is why I put Lionel Messi 2012, because he scored 91 goals for club and country, and you don't really need to say anything else for that. But interesting selections of Ronaldo's.
Well, 2017, he didn't score the most goals in Champions League. That was 2014, where he scored 70. I think he scored 14 in 2017. Kind of a little weird little number switch going on there. Look, this was when he was at his goal scoring, not like literal peak in terms of numbers, but in terms of...
So why isn't he your centre forward?
Because I want to save the best for last, Jake. That's why. Because you look at him, he affected big games in 2017. He scored in loads of finals, but the most meaningful goals he scored in finals were obviously 2008, but then obviously 2017, where he scored those two goals against Juventus, killed Juventus, wearing that amazing purple kit, by the way. That Real Madrid kit was stupendous. For picking kits as the last... FIFA, I think that'd be high.
There you go.
He was just incredible. Big game goal scorer. Killed off Bayern Munich, albeit with some lucky offside calls, but just a genuine, phenomenal goal scorer.
As you said in a previous podcast, if VAR didn't exist though, you wouldn't have that. You wouldn't even have him as a pick, probably.
Well, if VAR didn't exist, I'd have to go 2014 if VAR didn't exist, because then you got 17 goals and stuff.
Ronaldo's. You had slightly different years.
You went for the one before me.
I went for 07. Yeah. Again, it's the first year that he was in it.
That was
and he was listed as a midfielder.
23 goals, 23 assists that season.
Sam's misunderstood.
You're confused. So mine is based on like the setting the Premier League record for goals that Mohamed Salah only just broke with 31.
Of course, you had to get Salah
in 2007-8. Yeah,
41 goals. In He's got 41 goals in 44 games that season. Yeah, that was very good.
I was toying with the 2017 iteration of Ronaldo. I think that's the only two seasons in which he's like won the league and the Champions League.
Yep.
But I went for this one just because. I think in both, he basically won every version of the Golden Boot, like the European
Trio. I'm starting
but this
to...
But this one is he's my winger, because he was...
That is when he was a winger as well.
He was a bit more of a flair player, funner to watch.
That was the really fun Ronaldo.
I mean, I would say in terms of pure fun, I think Sam has the one, because 2007 Cristiano was before he got massive, enormous lats and just started scoring goals for fun. It was like he was scoring goals for fun, but also really dribbling, really being exciting.
2008 was the 900-yard goal against Porto.
Yes, I think it was the push cast as well. So.
Yeah, I now am annoyed that I didn't pick that as my winger, because that was a fun version of Cristiano Ronaldo. But we move on to the final slot. So this is where I expect Sam.
Messi 2012.
Messi 2015. I'm being interesting.
Oh my God.
Oh my Lord. 91 goals.
I'll get back to you on that one, mate. Come on.
So this, I picked the 17 goal Champions League Ronaldo for my forward. Yeah, 17 goal Champions League round in 2014. Because that's a lot of goals in one Champions League campaign. And as my centre forward,
score goals.
I want him to score 17 goals in Champions League.
Yeah.
Mo. Well, I mean, why have you not picked someone that scored 91 goals in a year?
I knew all of you were going to pick Messi. Yeah. I thought let's just spread it around. Let's eulogise Lionel Messi. And I think really, if you're picking Cristiano and Messi in the same team, you don't need a Messi that's going to score 91 goals. You want a Messi who's perhaps a better creative player, more understanding team player, a player who knows how to find his great teammates in great positions to score goals. Because Cristiano can only do really one thing and does it very well: is score goals.
So he's not in 2008.
Well. Yes, but this again, I didn't pick 2008 Cristiano.
Sorry,
2017.
Sorry, carry
on. So again, if you've got Cristiano 2017 in your team, right, you want someone that's going to be able to score goals. Messi scored over 50 goals in 2015.
Rubbish.
But also able to load the bullets for Cristiano Ronaldo. And Messi was a supreme playmaker in 2015. His pass for Neymar in the 3-0 against Bayern Munich was wonderful. Obviously, he killed Bayern Munich with his own goals. And you know, he played really well in the away leg of that tie, playing these amazing through passes, pre-assists for Suarez to find Neymar against Bayern Munich in Munich. So yeah, he's just, and the magical goal in the Copa del Rey final where he runs past like four players, smashes it in the bottom corner. Messi is phenomenal whatever year you pick him, really, between his career 2009 well, especially between 2009 and now. He's basically just flawless. But this year, I love this year because he came back from adversity, won his first Ballon d'Or I think for 3 years or whatever it was, came back from injuries that had dogged in the previous years, played brilliantly, led the team, and was, like I said, he was more of a creative player rather than just a goal scoring machine.
In 2011-12, he played 60 games. This is for Barcelona. Yeah. Played 60 games, scored 73 goals, and provided 29 assists.
Yeah.
I think he's going to be creative enough for me.
That's a fair point. I'm not going to argue it's 2012 Messi. Was quite phenomenal.
Final little thing, and I know this is run beyond, but this was super fun to do. I had personally had a lot of fun doing it anyway. Did anyone consider who they might have done if it wasn't Messi and Ronaldo?
I literally did an entire team.
I know you did an entire team, but we're not going to do the entire team. Yeah, Will, did you look at anyone else?
No, Sam's nodded.
I did, yeah. I had Torres from 2009, who I would pair with my Steven Gerrard.
Who Will also had, but just didn't want to say.
If you're not picking one of those two, then obviously the winger is Ronaldinho 2006 or 2005, to be honest, if you want, whichever one. Pure hocus pocus, just unreal. It's not just that he was great, it's that he was deliriously fun to watch. His performance, if you look up on YouTube, his performance, Ronaldinho away to Milan in 2006 in the San Siro wearing this.
I was meant to look it up. What year was his shimmy toe punch?
2005 against Chelsea. And then 2006, he scored an even more impressive goal in a way because he got the ball against Chelsea and ran through John Terry, like knocked John Terry on his backside.
Which year? 2006. Luckily, I chose 2005 John Terry in my team.
Yeah, 2006 he did that. And then also he had this performance in Milan. Again, look it up on YouTube. Ronaldinho away to Milan 2006. He doesn't give the ball away. He's incredible. Has this movement where he's juggling the ball.
Okay.
Ronaldinho.
And your other player?
I'm going to say Radamel Falcao.
That was going to be, if I wanted to cause trouble, I would have picked him in that 2012 team.
No striker is just, he's just.
That was his, was that his 18 goals in the Europa League season?
Porto.
Which is
Europa League, eh?
Yeah, exactly. So the Europa Conference League though. Yeah. Soon we'll be seeing 40 in that.
I mean,
Falcao holds the record for most goals in a, I know Europa League is technically second tier, but most goals in a European season. So 17 Ronaldo Champions League, 18 Falcao Europa League. I also just wanted to say that Omri and Eto'o both were slightly too... Omri was too late.
Yeah.
If Omri 2003 was there, 20 assists, 20 goals,
pick.
I think he would have been in my team anyway.
Yeah.
Just who would he be replacing, Ronaldo or Messi?
I think I'd probably move you can't not pick someone that scores 91 goals.
Yeah.
So I'd put him with Henry there.
But yeah,
Eto'o was another one, but I couldn't quite find the year that matched up.
2006 obviously scored in the final. Yeah. 2009 he played more of a team role.
Scored in a final that was an absolute robbery.
I mean, if VAR was existing. Mind you, if VAR was existing, Arsenal wouldn't have scored that goal because Ibarra did dive to win that free kick. But
Ivan's fine.
Eto'o was a great shot. I was torn between Eto'o 2006 and Falcao 2012, but I went with Falcao, and then just because I wanted to have Ronaldinho in 2006, I wanted to have my
chemistry.
Yeah,
but that'll be it. We will be posting our score for sixes. Please get involved and let us know your one. It's really fun to just look through. You can just go on the Wikipedia page, look through all the 11s, and then try and come to a decision. We ended up with more varied score for sixes of 11s than I thought, which was actually really good. So that's it, really. Man United, Arsenal done, Madrid derby done, and the return of the score for six done. Thank you all for listening, and we'll see you on Monday, actually, because we're away for next Thursday, so you get an extra Squawker Talker, which is good news for everyone. So get your mum involved and get...